the strongest marriages that you've seen? Love is part of it, but respect is the key underlying theme, right? Both partners bring out the best in each other. There's a respect, a mutual respect. And I say to executives and CEOs, you need to think of this merger the same way. If you want this partnership to succeed, you both need to come to this with respect for the other side and what each of you can contribute. And that's when I've seen deals be successful, when there is that level of respect.
Welcome to the World Class Leaders Show. This is the one and only podcast for ambitious and high achievers, professionals who want to become world-class leaders. In this podcast, we deconstruct the success of high-performance leaders, share their stories, and teach the most effective strategies to move from average to greatness. This is your host, Andrea Petroni, a high-performance and leadership advisor, executive coach, and keynote speaker with more than 20 years of international and executive corporate experience.
Welcome everyone to a new episode of the World Class Leaders Show. And today I have with me Jennifer Fondrave. Jennifer, I hope I pronounced correctly, Jennifer.
You did.
So Jennifer is the founder and chief humanity officer of Day One Ready, a consultancy that advises forward thinking business leaders, owners, and C-suite executives on how to prepare for and manage the people challenges of business transitions, particularly mergers and acquisitions. As a Fortune 500 C-suite marketing executive, Jennifer has written amazing books. They've been actually on top of the chart on Amazon. She will tell us maybe a little bit more about that a little bit later. But it's interesting because she shared her M&A expertise as a contributor as well to Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, Forbes, Tribe Global, and many other publications. So she's a sought-after podcast guest as well and keynote speaker for conference and association. So, Jennifer, welcome to the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, the topic we're going to cover today, for me, is super relevant. So merger acquisition, because there are so many interesting stories, good stories, but also bad stories. But what I think is a good way to start this episode is understanding why you do what you do. So why you have decided to work with business leaders on merger acquisitions.
Well, it's funny because in a recent webinar, the host said, so what's a nice girl like you doing in mergers and acquisitions? And I said, well, you go through a merger and acquisition. In my case, I went through three multi-billion dollar acquisitions.
Wow.
And by the third acquisition, I thought there's just got to be a better way to do M&A. One in which, now I should qualify, right? I went through multi-billion dollar acquisitions. So high stakes and a lot of change and transformation.
Yes.
And I learned by that third acquisition that where I felt that the attention hadn't been paid enough was on the people piece. Human nature, human behavior, what people go through when they're experiencing massive change. And in mergers and acquisitions, it inevitably is massive change, right? Both companies are looking for growth, whether it's a merger or an acquisition, and both companies need each other, but that can get lost in the transaction discussion. And so I started the journey, my M&A journey, simply with the thought of writing a book, the book you noted. Mm-hmm. It's a survivor's handbook, but also an executive's playbook, because yes. I was an executive in all three of those M&A deals. And I felt that there wasn't enough literature out there to help executives really understand how to navigate, how to lead, how to pivot quickly when the strategies keep changing, and how to get your team to really rally around it and see the opportunity, not to stay stuck in denial, but to get to acceptance. And so I wrote a book that I was looking for when I went through my M&A deals in order to help people navigate it better and leaders lead better through mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. And I'm going to ask you maybe a few questions later, and then it's up to you whether you can answer or not about, you know, the experience that you went through in the past. Because I think that's super interesting, because these are real stories, right? Because when it comes to merger acquisition, sometimes there is a risk of, you know, we're talking about very high level stuff. So,
and
Jennifer,
I'm happy to. My whole book is stories, not just my stories, but other executives. I interviewed about 60 executives, CEOs, CFOs, HR leaders, private equity, to try and share the stories, but not just have them be, as you said, you know, there's good stories and bad stories. I got tired of hearing people sharing war stories, but then not doing something to try and change that. Yes. And so that's the intent of the book, to bring those stories to light in a way that says, but here's how you can do it better.
And I think you're right. I think there is a tendency of accepting the fact that merge can fail and, you know, and just move on, right?
Right.
What is the number one lesson that you learn in merge and acquisition processes?
That you have to get to acceptance. And I will tell you, in that first acquisition, so the very first one was when Navtech, digital map maker, the leading digital map maker at the time, it was acquired by Nokia in 2008 for $8.1 billion, yes. Which at the time was an enormous amount of money. Now, you know, we throw around billions like it's monopoly money. But at the time, that was a massive deal. And, you know, I know, and I talk about it in the book, I struggled a lot with getting to acceptance. I had been really good. I had performed well against our success metrics. Navtech was B2B. We serviced our customers really well. Nokia was B2C. And that culture clash contributed. There were a lot of other variables, but certainly I felt that culture clash contributed to our not achieving the success. And both sides came to the partnership with arrogance. So I don't put blame on one side or the other. But for me, that big lesson is what I try and help executives with now, understand that their workforce, they have to help them get from denial to acceptance. And it's very easy to stay stuck in denial, because people, you know, you need to embrace change, but sometimes it's hard to recognize that, okay, people don't care about my past achievements. What they care about is how can I contribute to the future? You know, so I talk with leaders about helping not just themselves, but their teams understand, don't stay backwards bound. You need to be future focused. How can you contribute to the future? And that was for me, the biggest lesson that I learned and what I repeatedly am trying to help individuals see as well.
Yeah, because I mean, in my experience too, the main reason why change doesn't work or doesn't happen in an organization, because there is always a very high level of resistance. And Absolutely. That level of resistance is very difficult to fight.
Because think about it, your past achievements is what you define your value around. You think that's what makes me valuable. But in a merger and acquisition scenario, the metrics for success change almost overnight, and they can keep recalibrating as a company, you know, in every M&A I went through, right? They keep shifting as they try and figure out what's going to work and what won't. And so you need to be agile. But it took me a while to realize that the success I'd had in the past was great for the past, but what I needed to focus on was accepting that change had happened. Because then it opens up opportunities for you. You can see the opportunities once you get to acceptance. You know, your energy isn't around proving how good you were in the past. Your energy is about how can I contribute to the future and where are those opportunities? But I will tell you, I make it sound as though this is, you know, let's just get there. But it's a journey and you have to learn it. And my book and what I talk about now is to help people understand and appreciate that.
And that is actually is very good. Point what you are saying, because I mean what we are saying here is a leadership responsibility at the end of the day, making sure that change happen in organizations. So the merge acquisition, you know, is not as bad as it looks like maybe on paper, right? And one of the, and I'm glad that you mentioned the culture, because is a fact now that most of, I mean, the main reason why merge fail is actually is a culture clash. It's not much about strategic fit, operation fit, or financial fit. So, but it's really up to the leader understanding, first of all, understanding before, right? Before starting that process, what could be the cultural difference between organizations? But in my experience, doesn't really work there. So it doesn't really happen. What is your experience on understanding culture before the whole process?
And that, well, that's part of the work that I do now. It is, fortunately, as you said, it's being acknowledged, the importance of culture, that that should be a bigger part of the due diligence discussion. The tendency is to focus on the transaction, understandably, right? Our, you know, what's the forecasting? What's the valuation? But equally, what needs to be part of that is how are these cultures going to work together, and identifying where there might be clashes, where there could be great synergies. The synergies, the tendency is to look for where are our efficiencies, where are the redundancies, where do we get rid of things? And the focus that I have is, but where are the opportunities? Where are the synergies in culture so that we can build on that? And the analogy that I use, and it's, I'm sure you'll feel the same way. I talk about countries and country cultures, mm-hmm. right? When you go to a foreign country, the best way to understand their culture, learn their language, learn their history, understand what makes people from Italy, you know, the way they are, people from France, the way they are. And I talk about companies have the same thing, to learn their culture. Spend time getting to know their language. Are they a product marketing focused company? Are they a sales oriented? Are they marketing period? It's taking the time to get to know the culture of the other company and then identifying. So what are their best practices? What are things that they do? What are things that we do? It takes humility, which is not tended, then is not necessarily the nature of how companies come together in M&A. But consistently, when I was interviewing CEOs, they said their biggest lesson learned was they wish they had come to the deal with greater humility, an wow. understanding and an acknowledgement that both sides needed each other to succeed. And the CEOs who were successful later with their M&A, it's because they acknowledged that. How can we bring the best of both of us to this partnership?
It's fascinating that, I mean, We know that, right? We know how much is important to understand, not as you actually correctly say, it's not just a company culture, but also sometimes if there is an international transaction, right? Also the country culture that makes another element, another factor.
Right.
Is another factor for success. And it's funny because, I mean, I remember at least 4 or 5 major failures, merge failures in our history, at least 4 or 5. I'm sure that you have your own list. Right?
Well, according to Harvard Business Review and McKinsey, we continue to be at a 70-90% failure rate.
There you go. I didn't know that.
It's significant.
It is funny because the most tragic failures actually have been for that specific reason. There was clearly a cultural clash between the two organizations. I remember the AOL Time and Warner, maybe is one of the most famous, incredible merge that failed in the 90s. But then also, I remember well at that time, the Sprint and Nexel, the HP and Compaq. So there are many different failures. And most of the time, as far as I remember, was because really the culture internally was very different, but to the extreme between the two organizations. So one was, for example, very bureaucratic, very structured, and the other organization was more entrepreneurial, where there were no right. fixed roles. Is that one of the main or most common situation when you come across, when it comes to different culture between two organizations?
Yeah. I mean, it's as you said, right? There's history of that, where you have a corporate culture that takes on an entrepreneurial oriented culture, and they tend to want to acquire that company for the fact that they're fast to market, right? They're they're agile, they move quickly, they have a different perspective on the consumer market. And as a result of that, they are acquired. But then you have everything you acquired that company for starts to get absorbed into the corporate culture. And I'm sure you've seen it as well. You lose talent. You can have stagnation, productivity drops. And as a result, everything that you acquired unfortunately starts to disappear over time. And there are legions of stories around that. But the thing is, I don't want to focus on just the negative, but the important aspect of this, and it's the reason why I use the country culture example that I use, isn't just for when it's a multinational. I say use that mindset, even if it, let's say it was just in the United States. If you were going somewhere, if you were going to another country, the best way to experience that country is to learn that language and really understand the people. And I say, use that same kind of mindset when you are coming together with another company. And the best analogy that I can use is, think about the best partnerships, the strongest marriages that you've seen. Love is part of it, but respect is the yes. Key underlying theme, right? Both partners bring out the best in each other. There's a respect, a mutual respect. And I say to executives and CEOs, you need to think of this merger the same way. If you want this partnership to succeed, you both need to come to this with respect for the other side and what each of you can contribute. And that's when I've seen deals be successful, when there is that level of respect.
That's amazing. I agree with you. Now, I have a question though. So even when there is a respect in place, and maybe not love, but it's certainly respect between parties, but what's going to happen when there are so different approach to run a business? So in other words, for example, what's the risk tolerance, for example, or how they're making decisions. So sometimes the organizations are very, very different. So have you ever come across with organization, they're merging, and maybe there is a mutual respect. There is an element of, okay, I understand we are different, but we're going to work together. But you think it's still possible to build a successful merge at extremes, like the example I gave you?
I do, but there has to be a lot of self-awareness, a lot of awareness on both sides. And the times where I've seen, there's two scenarios. Those companies who have that level of respect, but have had great best practices on their own, right? As you said, sometimes it's hard to find common ground. One of the stories that I share in my book is, and I don't name names because the book is not about which companies failed.
Yeah, we did well. Yeah, exactly.
But the example was, both sides were coming together, but they weren't finding compromise. Right. Both felt that they had the best practice until it was a lower level manager that said, listen, we've got to stop looking at this from who does it best, but put the client front and center, our customer. And it's when they put up pictures of the customer in the room and said, this needs to be our North Star. You've always got to have the client at the center. How do we serve them best? Maybe it's some of what we do, maybe it's some of what you do, but it helps shift the focus and energy from what's our best practice to what serves the client best. And he said in that moment, it really helped them appreciate that they were fighting and missing the bigger picture. And I think that's a critical lesson learned. The other scenario that frankly, is tougher, but sometimes you need to change out the management team. You need new blood, new perspective. Because, and I will say, I absolutely was this way in my first acquisition. You are very proud of your achievements, right? You think this is what made you acquire us, or this is what made us interesting to merge with. But the reality is that oftentimes you can stay entrenched in that. And if you stay entrenched, you're not helping move the ball forward and bringing new energy in that doesn't have that baggage, that doesn't have that background, can look more objectively at what needs to be done. So those would be, I would say, Andrea, the two really ways that I've seen it be successful.
Yeah, and on the first thing that you said, actually, I'm 100% with you, because once you start really put the client first, everything changed. The differences they started to be, you know, less bigger than we think. Actually, I did a work a few weeks ago with the organization. They went through a merge, and now they're trying to work together for the first time, and they are facing similar problems. But as soon as we actually moved all the conversation to be a client-centric organization, everything changed in a bit, because they start to say, yeah, it doesn't really matter what we do, what we are doing now, because the client is, for us, the most important thing. Actually, not only who is the client now, but what's going to be the client in the future, because it might require a different thinking as well.
Right.
So yeah,
and
it's brilliant.
That mentality allows you to be less territorial.
Yes.
Because exactly. It becomes more about what are the best processes, systems, and procedures that serve our client best. But it takes, you know, it takes someone to step back and go, wait a minute, what's best for who we serve, and not what's our agenda.
And it's funny that you mentioned about integration, though, in terms of processes and maybe technology. I would like to go back to this, because I have a question. But back to your second point, in terms of people, you know, sometimes you're right. You know, it's unfortunate we have to make some changes, because that's the only way to make it work. On the other end, though, we have to be careful not losing the key people, right?
Absolutely.
So what is the best approach in doing that? Before that thing, because, you know, people that can get frustrated, maybe they lose motivation to say, oh gosh, another merge, or what's going to happen to me, you know? So there is always an element of fear, of course.
Right.
So what is your best strategy to retain the key people then?
Well, one of the things I talk about a lot with executives is when they're evaluating, how are we going to approach this integration?
Yes.
And it's what I unfortunately feel that I suffered in the M&A deals that I experienced. You suddenly get defined by a box, right? What's my job description? But you and I'm sure everyone listening knows we aren't that job description. There are so many more roles that we play in an organization. And so I say to executives, don't just go by, you know, this person's a level 13 employee with XYZ rating. Think about what role have they played? Because it goes beyond just the box. And it, particularly when I'm talking with the HR executive, it's critical, because oftentimes, and I had this experience, and I've seen it with other companies as well that I've worked with, you can lose, suddenly say, we no longer need this department, right? This, we're not going in that direction.
Yes.
But as strategies shift and change, suddenly that team that you've potentially, you know, let go, now you need them back. You know, there's horror stories about that. And so I say, listen, I get that part of M&A is to find efficiencies and remove redundancies. But at the same time, don't define people just simply by the box they're in or the job description that they have. And one of the upsides of COVID, I think, is this focus on reskilling, upskilling, training people, a greater focus on learning and development. Because what I say to HR people is, these are people who could still be critical to you. What are ways that through upskilling, they can still be contributing to the company? Particularly now with the war on talent, you want to figure out, how do we keep people who actually already know the systems, the procedures, how things operate, and potentially put them in a different role, as opposed to, well, they're part of this department, we don't need this group anymore. You need to think broader and bigger about your talent that you have. And that's why one of the things I'm thankful for is this greater focus on skills, training, and development.
Totally. Job rotation is by far one of the most underrated strategies, actually, that you can implement in an organization when these things happen. And also, I think it's interesting, you know, back to the point that we were saying before in terms of resistance, because sometimes even the key people maybe are the people that are most resistant for a number of reasons. So the real question
about that. Yeah.
There you go. Because you don't want to lose them. But...
That, The Fast Company article you noted in my bio, right? I talk about you can have people who are rock stars who become former rock stars because when the metrics for success change, they were really good in the against the prior success metrics. But then when they shift, they have a very hard time pivoting. And so, they can become a former rock star, unfortunately, rather quickly.
So what is your suggestion, actually? Imagine that you have to make a decision of, keeping them or let them go because they are high resistant, but they're important for organization. What is your suggestion on that? Because I have my idea on that.
Well, so there's a couple that I talk about in my book. I go more in depth in the Fast Company article, but in how to deal with a former rock star, one, I say you can't coddle them. Right. Because oftentimes that person is waiting for things to go back to the way they were.
Yes.
They can be stuck in denial for a while. And I'll say you can't coddle that type of personality, but you can speak to them about the fact that their expertise is invaluable. Acknowledge what they contributed in the past, but you need to help them shift and focus on. So how do you contribute that to the future? How do you take what you are so good at and now contribute to the new way of doing things? Be a part of creating that, what that new way is. Instead of hoping it's not going to change and that we're going to go back to the way we were, you've got to, again, get to acceptance and pivot. So there needs to be an acknowledgement of what they contributed to the past.
Right.
But then it needs to be being realistic and pragmatic and saying, but now you need to look at how do I contribute to the future and lead by example? Because the more a person who's potentially going to become a former rock star, the more that they see that everyone is moving in that direction, is adapting and embracing it, the greater chance there is for them to do as well. But at a certain point, and I make this clear in the book as well, you can't, and particularly when I'm working with HR, you can't cave in, right? You can't, constantly try and acquiesce and adapt. That person needs to embrace that things have changed and that they have an opportunity to contribute, but they've got to adapt and evolve in how they contribute.
Yeah, at some point, sooner or later, he has to align anyway with the organization, with the changes that is happening. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for him and for organization, honestly, to work with him, right? So, yeah, I agree with you on that. I would like to shift a bit the conversation now more into the leadership because, we've been talking more about people. They are essentially they are on the receiving end of a merge acquisition. So they need to adapt, they need to change, et cetera. But leaders, they have a first responsibility to make sure that change happens in a good, in the best way possible. And when there is a big change required to make sure that merge happens and works well, leaders, they need to set the tone, right?
Right.
So what is your, do you do any work specific with the leaders on, hey, you have to change first and then you need to show the organization that, you're embracing this change, et cetera. So what is your view about behavioral changes on leaders when it comes to merger and acquisition?
Well, it's interesting. The article that I wrote for HBR, How to Avoid Us Versus Them Thinking, after the deal, that's where I've had consistently executives say, I want to unpack that. I want to better understand how do we avoid that. And I talk about the three dynamics of us versus them. Because the one that everyone always focuses on is our company versus their company, right? How do we avoid that? So that's, that's table stakes.
Yeah,
because
us and you,
everyone's already thinking that way.
Yes.
But I'd say you also have to understand there's two other dynamics at play. There's the executives versus frontline. Because as executives, even if you weren't in the room when the deal was made, typically you know, something's happening, your boss has alerted you. The rest of the organization, though, is now learning it for the first time. So if you're a senior leader who's known about the deal for a while, you need to understand the people are going to go through a journey. They need time. I talk about the fact that they'll, depending on the magnitude of the deal, they'll go through stages of grief, as I alluded to before, right? To get from denial to acceptance. So I'll say executives, you need to understand that the workforce not only is going to go through these stages, but they may also be feeling blindsided, right? They may feel like, why was I not told? Why was I not aware? And why didn't anyone ask me my opinion? You know, I've got legions of stories where you have that dynamic happening. And then the third piece is the who stays versus who goes. And what was fascinating in my research on this is both sides think the other side has it better. Those who stay think, I now have three times as much work as I did before. Right. Those people who left, you know, get to go on and pursue another career, do something different. While now I feel like I'm overwhelmed. Nobody respects what I do and I'm not feeling valued. But then those who leave will wonder, why wasn't I picked? Why didn't I get to stay? And so part of the work that I do with executives is to paint that bigger picture. It's not just our company versus their company. I help executives appreciate there's a journey that people go through. You've gone through it. You may have even contributed to what that new strategy is going to be, but you need to respect and understand that your workforce now can feel blindsided, unhappy about the change, and you need to help them get to acceptance. So that's why a big part of my work is about helping executives not only see that, but then helping move their teams along. And consistently, particularly when I work with executives who are at the very beginning, right before the integration starts, they've said how invaluable having that awareness was as they went in, because they better understood what the feelings were of their teams by having talked about it in advance.
Yeah, and that's brilliant. I think that's exactly what is needed. Now, I have a question, though. So I see sometimes leaders during this major change initiative, because it's a change initiative at the end of the day in MBA, right, setting the tone at the beginning, maybe setting the vision, communicating quite well, you know, what's going to happen, etc. But then they tend to step back and going back to, you know, doing what they do. I'm not saying they're forgetting the acquisition, but they start to, I don't even think it's right saying losing interest, but they are less committed or they are less involved because, of course, you know, they delegate, they rely on their leadership team, on the management team, but I still believe they need to be more present in the process. Is it something that you see or absolutely, it's just...
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And I don't get credit. So John Cotter, who wrote the seminal book, Leading Change.
Yes.
One of the tenets that he highlights that I talk about in my book as well is you have to be consistent in your behavior, and your behavior isn't just, you know, the big town hall meeting or the email that you write. It's even in your body language. You need to role model continuously the behavior of embracing the change and acknowledging the change. And it's interesting. And I think Erica Dwan has a great book out now, Digital Body Language. Okay. And it talks about now we're in a whole new world, right? So much of our communication, right? You're looking for cues in a little box, you know, with 1,000 faces on a Zoom screen. But people are still looking for cues, right? They're looking for, are they paying attention? Do they have their camera on? Do they have it off? You know, one of the things I coach executives on, and I use an example from my book where one leader was trying to be deferential to a new product that the other company was bringing to market. So he talked consistently about that other product first, right? Just to highlight it. But his own team started to think, well, I guess he's not behind our product anymore. He doesn't talk about us first. He doesn't highlight where we are. And so in a meeting, I think it was about a month later, he said he learned from the team lead that they actually had slowed things down because they thought he was no longer interested in the product. So he hadn't realized by prioritizing in his messaging and communications that other product that his own team had been thinking, well, you know, Joe's not as interested in our product anymore. And so I highlight that because it's people look for cues in every way possible. And I talk about this in the book, right? People are going to read between the lines. And it's why your communication needs to be consistent. But it's not just verbal. It's how you show up. It's how you even prioritize. It's who you put on the email, who's on the to line and who's on the CC line. Even that gets evaluated. So it's having that level of awareness as leaders that you need to be smart on.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, because in this workshop that we actually ran a few weeks ago, one of the things that came out from the people was, you know what, we need to write our own code of our communicating with mm-hmm. each other, because you're right. I mean, in the current digital world, there is an abuse of, you know, emails that are written. There are too many people involved in that email, people that are not necessarily need to be there. And I think if you start from the leadership, is not the case of this specific situation I'm mentioning, but if it doesn't start with the leaders, with a good practice, how communicating right. internally, I think it's going to be just a disaster then across the organization. So, you know, it's back to my question you answered properly, you know, is leaders, they need to set the tone in, right. in everything they do. And you're right, body message as well, body language is super important. And also you mentioned—
I just one other thing that I would yeah. highlight part of that, you know, going back to our discussion on rock stars, right? When someone who's a rock star, you know, starts to dig in and says, I don't believe in this. Mm. But when they do pivot, when they do start to go, okay, I can see how this can be good for the company, right? It may take them a while, but when they do, they can be amazing role models for the rest of the organization, because you'll have people who sit on the fence who are waiting to see, okay, which way is this going to go? So one of the things I talk about a lot is when you have someone who's been a rock star, then, you know, digs in, but then starts to pivot, really encouraging them, be that role model for the organization, be that person that says, this is good direction for us. This is a huge opportunity for our company. Let's move forward, because then you will have more people who've been sitting on the fence that fall in line. So to your point, it's, you know, role models, the leadership has that opportunity, but those people who've been resistant, but then pivot can be enormously powerful in galvanizing the rest of the workforce.
Right, totally. I mean, there is a rule of thumb in many organizations that says 33% are accepting and promoting the change. 33%, they're just hate it and they're going to resist until
right.
the end. And then there is also 33% that is there waiting, you know, I always say dancing in the moment to try to understand right. whether they're going to go with the pros or with the cons. And you have to right. win them, because they're going to move and exactly. shake everything, right?
That's why I say it's that middle yes. group. The yes. bottom group, you won't. They won't be happy, period. But exactly that middle right. group, those are the ones to focus
yeah.
on.
The winner, the success is there. Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Last question, then I have a few other questions at the end. But something very interesting for me, because I noticed in other transactional process, like the one that we are talking about, is how sharing knowledge internally, because, you know, we spoke about integration yeah. and roles and responsibilities and people. However, one of the things I notice quite often is the inability, especially if it's a large organization or they're very diverse or they're operating in very different countries or areas, the sharing knowledge internally doesn't really happen at the right speed. It takes a lot of time and sometimes not even completed. And they're probably losing opportunity actually to cross-sell, upselling, you know, building more integrated services or packages to the client, to the market. So in other words, maybe there is a strategic fit that might lead actually to increased revenues, getting more clients. But in reality, if they're not sharing internally their knowledge, right. their skills, all the leverage, unfortunately, doesn't happen. So do you have a view about how fostering sharing
knowledge? I do. Well, and my view starts with, so you bring up probably the key reason, in my view, that M&A tend to not be successful. It's because trust is such an implicit part of business success. And in an M&A scenario, it dissolves overnight. Because now, you know, as we've talked about, we have the us versus them, our company versus their company, executives versus, you know, there's that dynamic going on. So the focus that I have, and I talked about this in the HBR piece and in the book, it's how do we get that trust back, right? Not just our company versus their company, but the executives and front lines, and focus on that trust building. And, you know, the big focus that I had for the book is leadership has that role, but as an individual, you play that role too. How do you build that trust with the other company? So I talk a lot about trying to get to know the other side, doing your part, right? And not just having meetings that are purely about the business. How do you get to know the other team members for who they are, what they do, what are they interested in? And frankly, it's been a big part of even the discussions with COVID, right? The people are starting to get to know one another because now suddenly you're seeing them in their living room, right? You're realizing your coworkers are people. And so I talk about that as a key aspect of building that trust back, because that distrust is what keeps people from sharing information because they're trying to figure out what's going on. So I focus a lot of, you know, learning to collaborate. One, putting the client first, making them your North Star, but then also getting to know the people who you are potentially going to work with beyond just the project or the, you know, the initiative. And that's a huge part of it, getting to know them for who they are. And it's, you know, you bring up one of the critical issues, because part of that distrust comes from people don't always know the answers, right? There's the compliance and the legal aspect, right? You can't always share. There's the confidentiality. But then sometimes there are a lot of questions that happen at the beginning that leadership doesn't know the answer to. It's still being determined. And so I talk about the fact that the more you as leaders can acknowledge, here's what I know, and here's what I don't know, but here's these things that I don't know we are working on. And you want to foster that conversation with your teams. Because if you don't acknowledge, then, and I'm sure you've seen this as well, people will make up worst case scenarios. They will conjure up the worst thing that could possibly happen. So as leaders, you need to be continuously acknowledging, here's what we're working on. This is what I don't know, but we are in the process of establishing. Mm-hmm. What else do I need to know? What are other things? What are obstacles? What are decision-making log jams that you are experiencing that I need to be aware of, so that we can have that on the list of things to be addressing? Because if, you know, you'll also have people who are worried about, well, I don't want to always be, you know, sharing bad news, but you have to be sharing what's going on and where you're meeting up with obstacles. And so that fostering communication is critical for leadership.
And I do agree. Without trust, then it's impossible to share knowledge and insights and skills internally. But you can't build trust if you don't really start off getting to know, you know, the other colleagues and people. And I think is, you made a very great point. I think that one of the main responsibilities of leaders is actually building their relationship internally, in particular when you do a merger and acquisition, because there are so many different people. They need to know each other first before asking them to sharing. And, you know, even actually earning trust is not a simple, a quick process, but it doesn't start if you don't know the other people, right? And too many organizations, they don't really, especially right now, because, you know, just having a camera doesn't mean that you build a relationship. You have to do something more to help people build a relationship, right?
Yeah. And one of the things that became clear, even in my own experiences, it's not just, do I trust that other company? But you can have people who say, do I now trust the people I work with? Do I trust my leadership? I didn't know this deal was happening. And now suddenly it's happened.
Exactly right.
You know, there's even that internal trust that dissolves. So that you need to be aware of that and build that back. And that's where executives have said, it was invaluable for them to realize that that's what they were going to be facing and to be prepared for it.
It's funny because we started with the word culture, and we are ending this conversation about culture. That's what we were talking about, having a culture of trust in an organization, because without that, everything unfortunately is not going to work. Either is a merger acquisition or any other important initiative or project the organization are running. So, Jennifer, that was fantastic. So Would you like to go with a very quick fireside chat at the end here?
Sure.
Question number one is, you mentioned already, but maybe there is something else. What is the number one lesson that you learn throughout your whole career?
Well, you're right. I did mention it's knowing your value, right? I think the more you know your value, what your worth is and how you contribute, the better you're able to navigate uncertainty. And I think, as I shared, I had attached my value to my past achievements. You need to understand your value is how you contribute to the future, how you take your skills, everything you've learned, and continue to contribute that to a new way forward. It took a long time. I feel like I'm still learning that lesson. You never finish learning it, you know, but the clearer you are on your value and your unique contribution, the better able you are to just navigate anything that comes at you.
And we mentioned, I think, episode number 5 with Don Antonucci, CEO of a healthcare organization in the US. You know, he centers his leadership about self-awareness. So that's what we're talking about. So absolutely right. The other question I have for you is about performance. So do you remember when you had your best performance as an individual, as a professional? What was in place at that time that allowed you to be a super high achiever?
This probably will go against what you would think. There were low expectations, right? I had just been appointed the marketing director at NAFTEC. I'd moved abroad. I brought my husband and my two kids to Paris, France, and my team was European. And marketing had been positioned in a certain way within the company. They were suspicious of me, but we had nothing to lose, right? It was all about, okay, how do we prove to the company the value that we can bring? And we pulled off an amazing trade show effort at the International Auto Show in Frankfurt. This was back in 2005. Uh-huh. And I just will never forget. And it's because each of us brought our talent, our effort, and attitude. We focused on what we could control and said, we're just going to go all in. And everyone brought their individual talent to this. But I would say it's because, you know, expectations were at a certain amount or a certain level, and we blew it out of the park because we just said, let's go all in and show them what this team is capable of. And it was enormously rewarding for me because as a new leader, my team felt, okay, this is someone we can trust. This is someone who is going to help us really contribute. And then the rest of the organization saw our team in a completely different light. And that was enormously rewarding. And I talk about that in one of my keynotes, you know, what it feels like when you're a team that thinks we got this.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Throw anything at us. We'll make it work.
Yeah, you know, it's really under promise and over deliver. That's how I hear it.
Actually, we didn't even. I think it was just people were like, wow, you know, and I said, hey, never underestimate.
There you go. So next question is, what would you have done differently in your career on the other end?
You know, I think it's a tough one to answer because I don't look back on my career with regrets. I look back at even those things where I feel like, ugh, that didn't go as well as I thought. What do you learn from that? What do you take from that? You know, I think people often say, you know, it's important to acknowledge your failures. Failures make you better, but I'm sure you feel the same way. When you're in the middle of a failure, it is not fun. You're not thinking, wow, this is going to make me stronger in the future. But I would say I don't live with regrets. I've learned from the failures. Here's a perfect example. It took me a while to pivot during all of those M&A. I learned from that. I don't think I was the best version of myself. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a book to help others be better executives, to learn how to lead through, you know, constant change and uncertainty. So that's, I see that. That's what I would say. Learn from it and help others, right? Share that knowledge.
Totally. Yeah, I love that. Who is actually your best business leader from your experience and why?
You know, it's someone who I admire. Angela Merkel is the person who comes to mind. And, you know, I know she's in the world of politics, but I would say And fortunately, a lot has been written about her. You know, she's a science teacher. This is what I find so fascinating. Yes,
no one's talking about that, but yeah, she
is. Her training is as a science teacher, right? So she's practical, pragmatic. What's the data? But she also, I think, transcended that. And if you look back on her career and what she's navigated, leading Germany, you know, not just even in the period of COVID, but just through these last number of years, I think she's remarkable. And in fact, I was actually asked, Harvard Business Review put out a, who would you like us to interview? And I said, interview Angela Merkel. She's got lessons that we could all respect and learn from as business leaders.
That would be amazing actually to read it. And by the way, it's very timely conversation about Angela, you know, because she just left, bro. So that's very interesting to see what's going to happen to Germany, to the European Union after she stepped down. Finally, what is your best favorite business or leadership book?
It's one I've just read. I tend to like the old favorites. You know, I've mentioned Kotter and Leading Change. Dory Clark's book called The Long Game. Love that book. Because what I'm doing is the long game, right? I'm saying in mergers and acquisitions, exactly as you said, we've gotten too used to just saying, hey, sometimes they fail. And my belief is no, but you need to be intentional. You need to think about what is it that has made, M&A not successful in the past. And Dory Clark's book talks about how to be a long-term thinker in a short-term thinking world, right? We're so short-term. We've become about instant gratification. And she literally proposes, here's what you need to do. You need to be patient, but these are the steps to take to play the long game. And she gives me hope that as many people read the book, they'll start to realize and appreciate the importance of being a long game thinker.
It's funny because just for the audience, you know, there was no any pre-conversation with Jennifer about this question, just to explain that. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I just finished that book. And it's not only that, and I find it fantastic. I'm a big fan of John Kotter, and you mentioned twice, so The Leading Change. So, yeah, we're very well tuned, Jennifer and I, and I was sure about that. But, you know, sometimes it's funny that you realize by asking this question how people sometimes are close in their approach to life and business, etc. Jennifer, that was great. Jennifer, would you like just to mention your book? Because I think people, they would be very interesting to read the book and also where they can contact you. They want to be in touch with you.
Sure. So the book is called Now What? Survivor's Guide for Thriving Through Mergers and Acquisitions. For those people who think, I don't want to read a book on M&A, it's about just navigating change and uncertainty through business transformation. So while I use M&A stories and examples, all the readers who have reached out to me have said this was invaluable to them through just navigating change. You can find it on Amazon and wherever you might purchase your books online. And then you can reach me. One, I would say reach out on LinkedIn. I'd love when people reach out to connect, I post a lot of my content there. And then also my website, which is jenniferjfondreve.com.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really, thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. I hope you find it insightful. I think Jennifer has shared with us some amazing tips and strategies that we can all implement during challenging mergers or acquisition projects. Remember, culture is the number one reason why most of the mergers, they don't work as expected or they don't produce the return on investment. So make sure if you are in a position right now of leadership, make sure that you embrace some of the ideas or insights that have been shared in this amazing episode. And if you have any comments about the show or if you want to reach out for any ideas, insights, please feel free to drop me a line at andrea@andreapetroni.com or as well on social media, either on Twitter or on LinkedIn. You can find me there, connect, just saying who you are and that you listen to the episode. Remember as well to follow the podcast
and maybe share it with some of your friends or colleagues if you think that might be interested to the show. Thank you so much again, and I look forward to see you next time. Bye.